This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Have you ever stopped to wonder what exactly success means to you? Is it money, fame, power, all of the above, or none at all? I'm Dashran Johan, and this is Redefining Success, a show where we speak to passionate people from various fields about their lives, what makes them tick, and what the word success means to them. Joining me on the show today is Jason Wee. He's the co-founder of Architects of Diversity, that's an NGO. Welcome to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
Hey, Dashran. Thanks for having me back.
Before we get into the big picture that we're trying to explore here, which is your idea of success, tell me a little bit about Architects of Diversity.
Sure. So AOD was founded way back in 2018, and currently we're focusing on four pillars. The first one is building multicultural leaders for Malaysia. Second one being anti-discrimination education. We're also working on diversity, equity, and inclusion in education more broadly. And lastly, we're also working on making leaders from a multicultural democracy in Malaysia. Essentially, all at the essence, you know, what we're doing is we're building the capacity for youth to engage in issues of diversity and inclusion in Malaysia, be it through workshops, trainings, and other forms of advocacies that we do.
When you think of the word success, what does it mean to you? How do you define it?
Yeah, so success is a weird word, right? Because I think oftentimes we think of success as like kind of some arrival point or a destination.
Right.
Where, you know, we're reaching a certain spot and say, okay, we're successful now or we're not successful. I think for me, and, you know, more broadly first, it's that, you know, success isn't like a destination point, right? It's more of the hard work of the day in and the day out. And like, are you in a place where not only are you feeling personal fulfillment, but also are you perhaps achieving some form of external validation through that work? And I think, especially for me, since, you know, in this line of work where I do in AOD, especially if it tackles issues of race and religion, where in Malaysia, you know, it's so complicated.
Right.
There's no like one point where we're saying, okay, we're actually working towards, you know, the correct goal here, or, you know, people contend what is the correct goal. And so having a, you know, metric of success is really difficult, I think, in my opinion. And so I think it's more about having some form of vision of where you want to go and having that incremental spots going up to that point. I think more personally for me, success is a kind of a balance between both regulating internal versus external definitions of success, right? Obviously, we have our own personal kind of goals and metrics and like, okay, this is what I want to do versus what, you know, people tell us that, you know, when someone labels you successful or, you know, you get an award, all those are external definitions. I think success has to come a bit of both, right?
Right.
We're essentially social creatures. We crave validation. We crave, you know, a place in the world. And all those things are, you know, what makes us human. And I think that's very fair to say that some success means people are acknowledging your work and saying, good job, you know, a thumbs up and doing those kinds of things. I think internally it gets a bit more, you know, blurry in
right.
the sense that on one hand, it's obviously about happiness and fulfillment. Like, are you satisfied and can you see this doing something in the long term? Or do you wake up and say and are motivated to do what you do? And I think the second bit is, you know, kind of, you know, this typical concept of ikigai where, you know, are you good at what you do? Mm-hmm. Is it something the world needs? You know, can you get paid for it? And is it something you're passionate about? And so I think for me, it's balancing between the two kind of pulling tensions, right? And I think I'm very privileged to be at a point where the internal and external definitions of success are somewhat aligned. But I know for a fact that, you know, those definitions might not be aligned in the near future or so.
Right.
And so I think success for me is a constant negotiation of that internal and external conflict.
Right. And how much does your career factor into your definition of success?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a huge bunch, right? And mm-hmm. I think especially in this day and age where, you know, there's competing narratives of like work shouldn't define you or, you know, we kind of live in this capitalist world and
right.
there's so many external pressures and you should just kind of live your life. But at the same time, like you cannot deny the fact that one, we spend a huge chunk of our lives in work, right?
Absolutely.
Like no matter what, be it a 9-to-5 or be it more flexible hours, your work is still a huge chunk of that. And I think secondly, your work also puts you in a place where you're engaging a larger society, right? And you can't separate the two oftentimes. So obviously, you know, I think for me, work is a big part of how I would define, you know, success to myself. Because I think that means not only kind of an external validation thing, but I think internally it's answering a larger question of purpose and, you know, how am I contributing back to a larger community? And so that for me is really where work comes into a definition of success.
Right.
So, I mean, obviously, like, you know, I think the danger is, and I think we're all in danger of tying the work to success way too closely.
Right.
And I think that's where it can, you know, become a bit contentious when the, you know, external factors are beyond our control and there's only so much you can do about it. But I think, you know, it is, again, it's not one or the other. It's probably a bit of both.
Right. And, you know, you're clearly someone who's very passionate about the work that you do and find fulfillment from the work that you do. How did you develop the passion for this particular cause? Like you brought up earlier, you know, it's about, you know, tackling this issue of multiculturalism. How do you maneuver the landscape, building a more inclusive and diverse society and all of that? How do you develop a passion for this specifically?
Yeah. So I think, you know, many people have asked me this, and I think it always traces back to upbringing, right? And which environments I was in. So I went to a Sekolah Kebangsaan, so a national school. I went to SK Taman Mega, which was one of, you know, you could say more multicultural schools in Malaysia, where there was kind of even splits. We were primarily English speaking, however, but, you know, with vernacular still present. And so growing up in that environment was, you know, multiculturalism was kind of the norm for me.
Right.
Where, you know, most of my peers were mixed. You know, we had this kind of moment of where we didn't really care about, you know, external factors.
Absolutely.
You know, it was just the diversity that was present. Obviously, you know, going out into, you know, after secondary school and, you know, engaging the larger world, obviously all these things come with a shock. And so my question was, how do you kind of not rebuild, but like really take the lessons learned from my primary school experience and saying what made that work and how can that apply to larger factors.
Right.
I also, you know, went to United World College, which is, I did 2 years of school in Costa Rica, where I was surrounded by peers from 80 other nationalities, right? And that process was not clean. It's a very messy, oftentimes conflict prone environment.
Right.
But as you know, I was placed in an environment, you have to navigate those things. And so these are kind of like, I know, very broad questions of how do we work together and how do we build spaces that allow all identities to engage meaningfully and are respected. And all these, you know, things, I think I move into different spaces throughout my life. And these questions have just, you know, been constantly pounding at the door. And so for me, that's a huge source of motivation and passion.
Right. So when did you realize you could focus on this cause full time and essentially make it a career? Is that something you even thought about?
I think for me, you know, when I can really consider this like a possible full time job, I think even when I was younger in my teens, I was involved in so many programs that were organized by NGOs or, you know, was building that capacity for me. And so just having the opportunities to look at others and look at how other NGO founders or people who started their own things went about doing it was already a large inspiration for it. And so, you know, during my university days, those became very much plausible opportunities because I've seen it done before. And so obviously, you know, I think in any path you pursue, that exposure to those life paths, you know, are important. But I think also for me, I started AOD in kind of post GE14.
Right.
And so, you know, GE14 was, you know, I was very politically informed and engaged before that, but I think GE14 was kind of, for me, an opening that, you know, things are changing in Malaysia and there is room for change. And so a big part of that drive came from seeing that opportunity to navigate and to make your own, carve up some space within the country.
Right. So what would have happened had GE14 not taken place. The result of G14, the way our political landscape in Malaysia has changed. What if that didn't happen? I'm wondering, you know, what were you like back when you were in your schooling days? Did you get good grades? What were your interests and ambitions back then?
Yeah, that's a question, right? We're like entering into hypotheticals.
Right.
So obviously, like, you know, with the benefit of like hindsight, I could say that, you know, maybe perhaps that I wouldn't be in this path. Maybe I'd have engaged politics more directly. Mm-hmm. Perhaps, you know, I would have taken a safer path of engaging in a corporate career first and then maybe coming out a bit later and doing something I like. So I think in terms of that line, it's a bit hard to say given that, you know, that reality didn't happen. but I think for me personally, like, regardless of, you know, the circumstance, I was already pretty geared towards engaging, you know, socially and politically in the world. During my younger days, I actually was not I didn't stay in class a lot. In fact, in secondary school, you could probably find me outside of class, like doing some other thing rather than actually paying attention to lessons.
Right.
How I viewed kind of academics was kind of a necessary evil to say, okay, you know, I've clear, you know, I know where I want to go. I need the grades and I just need the grades
right
there. Right. But I think for me, when I was younger, a huge chunk of my life was actually part of the debate community. So with, you know, other individuals, like, you know, I was in the same cohort as, you know, YB Said Sadiq, that all of us were engaging in important topics of, you know, just questioning the world and discussing in, you know, in random classrooms in universities on the weekend, these huge questions of what the world is facing and the dilemmas around that. And I think the part of my younger childhood that allowed me to engage in kind of the NGO world as well is to be engaged in the broader world, right? To be able to feel a part of that and be able to question it and be surrounded by a community that supports that line of questioning. And that oftentimes doesn't happen in the classroom. And so I think that that piece of, you know, passion is one thing, but are you in an enabling an environment that allows for that paths to even emerge as a reality for you?
Absolutely. How much does money factor into your idea of success, of financials?
That's an interesting one. I think with me, how I viewed finances, and I think I come from a particularly privileged position where I don't have to worry about money too much. Is that one? I think finances kind of a bit like a necessary evil, right? It's something you just have to care about,
right?
Where at least for me, I think, you know, as long as it's the baseline of what I have, I would consider a comfortable life. But I think also negotiating that, you know, constant like dread of like, oh, it could be more,
right?
It could be more, you know, I could press more on that pedal and like focus more on money. But I think it's not a pedal to negate completely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for me, it's always, again, the necessary evil in life to just kind of consider. And because, you know, I wouldn't be in this career if it couldn't pay off financially as well.
Right.
Like, I couldn't sustain a life. And I think that's fair for any career, right? Mm-hmm. At any point in time. But I think how do you make sure that, you know, you're not receiving that kind of lifestyle inflation that makes the lifestyle unsustainable in that sense, right? And so I think finances for me is a necessary evil, but definitely a huge part of what constitutes success, because it is a mechanism to making sure that you are happy and fulfilled, to make sure that you're able to do and engage in the world in a meaningful way, that you're not constantly bogged down by, say, life conditions.
On the show with me today is Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity. After the break, I ask him how he measures growth. We'll be back with more on Redefining Success, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Redefining Success. I'm Darshan Johan, and on the show with me today is Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity. So Jason, what drives you, Jason, to keep doing what you're doing day in, day out?
So I think for me, it's kind of a bit cliche. I oftentimes think about this kind of like internal fire, right?
Right.
I think I would like to think, I don't know, this is not scientific feedback whatsoever, but I would like to think that a lot of us have some form of internal fire that keeps on burning.
Right.
For me, I go to sleep oftentimes, even during holidays, even when I'm not prompted. I think about, you know, questions of intergroup contact. I think about intergroup relations when I go to sleep. Like, and for a large part of my life, that was thinking about papers I've just read, scholarly papers, mm-hmm. or even just questions and dilemmas people have been putting out in public discourse. And I would go to bed thinking about them. And, you know, these are like, you know, intrusive thoughts to some extent, right. where you can't really get them out. So you just have to act on them.
Right.
Because I think for me, in a world that doesn't have these things, or a world where I'm not engaging in questions of race, of diversity and inclusion, is a world where I would constantly be bothered by that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, that's really where the passion point lies. And I know that's a very privileged thing to say, because that's for many people, perhaps you're going to bed and you're thinking about these things, and you might not be able to have the opportunities to engage in them.
Right.
I think for me, having the opportunity to engage in that in a constructive way, but also be able to go to bed and say, okay, I've really thought about this today. I've really acted on it today, and be able to go to bed, and kind of really fulfill that satisfaction is really where that passion lies.
Since starting AOD, did you ever need a day job, quote unquote, to sustain this path you've chosen, either gigs elsewhere or, you know, balancing between corporate life and AOD?
So I was very privileged that I, you know, one, during the starting days, received quite a number of grants that allowed me to pursue this, you know, as a student. And then after that, I also really received the fellowship that, you know, allowed me a full year's worth of salary and financial support to keep on doing AOD. So in terms of that, you know, that really supported that kickstart, that first move, right? And, you know, in the US where I went to university, there are so many like fellowship opportunities that we just don't see in Malaysia,
mm-hmm.
That just like trust the individual to do what they're doing. I know, I think, you know, Peter Thiel has a fellowship that
right.
Essentially like encourages people to drop out of school, and they will fund him for a few years, which is, you know, it's crazy if
yeah,
you think about it.
Absolutely.
Right? But those are things that you kind of disrupt that typical life path of someone, mm-hmm. right? And so I think I had a lot of those opportunities. But I think for me also, just I think for me, I approach this as an experiment. I mean, entering AOD every day, I mean, I've been going at this for like 2 or 3 years now. It's, I always approach it as one, an experiment where I'm conscious of the opportunities I've got, and there's always room to fail. Mm-hmm. So entering knowing that failing is the default, and I wouldn't say failing, you know, it could end any day,
right.
in some senses, right? Where this isn't like a thing where I will hold on to and think of it as like a merge part of my identity. Because I think that's something that's, you know, very plausible, where I merge myself
right.
with this career or this particular choice in its totality and not wanting to let it go. So I think a big part of why I've been able to be flexible cognitively in terms of thinking of what I want to do and where I can expand is knowing that this is an experiment. This was something that, you know, most people probably don't have the opportunity of doing, and I just had a few cards that lined up well. But one day, those cards could not line up, and mm-hmm. I know those external factors are out of my control, and I'm okay with that.
Right.
And so I think entering with that mindset allowed for me to adjust with new factors that come in every day. I know, I mean, even as you speak, you know, sometimes I'm very cognizant of the fact that things might change.
Right.
And, you know, as we're approaching GE15 and as we're approaching a ever-changing nation, where I might move might also change in that regard.
Right. You mentioned the word experiment. Were there points where you felt so far since starting AOD that this part isn't going to work out? Now, can be for various reasons, can be from finances, it can be from a sense of hopelessness of like the nature of the political landscape or whatever it may be. But have you felt like, okay, this isn't going to work out, and that, you know, I think I just need to drop everything and go and do the, you know, a traditional type of job, a corporate gig, things like that?
I mean, every day. I'll be like surprised, you know, founders are like, oh, like, think about, like, consider this every day. Right? But I think, I mean, obviously, like, there are big events that, like, you know, trigger this line of thinking. One, obviously, like, I really went full time when, like, COVID hit, right?
Right.
So it was really ironic because, you know, a big part of what, you know, AOD's fundamentals was intergroup contact. Mm-hmm. That meant bringing people together in the same room. COVID, when, you know, COVID happened, socially distancing and all these other SOPs, bringing people together in the same room was not possible.
Right.
So, you know, exploring different ways to go about that and while maintaining that sense of mission and purpose was definitely that huge challenge where, like, you know, I was like, you know, this is, you know, this unlucky point of day and time. But I'm glad we got over that. But I think beyond that, it's kind of the biggest challenges has been really the day in and day out. Mm-hmm. Where you're waking up and firefighting these kind of small challenges and that might distract you from the bigger picture. Those are, I think, for me, the bigger stumbling blocks along the way, where at some days, you know, it's oftentimes nothing's happening and you just have to convince yourself to go out and do it again.
Right.
I think that is oftentimes the discipline that comes as the biggest challenge in any, when you're doing your own thing, right? I think, you know, setting your own direction and then, like, really sticking to it is definitely, like, the biggest challenge.
Right. So you talk about, you know, that being one of the biggest challenge, right? What are some of the other challenges you've faced? You know, on two aspects, right? As one, you know, running AOD, and also two, in terms of trying to achieve AOD's primary objectives, like, you know, when you look at the big picture thing that AOD is trying to accomplish in Malaysia, what are some of the biggest challenges you faced over the past 2-3 years?
So I think for me, so on a more minute scale, even things like managing staff members, you know, really scaling faster,
right.
Those are hard skills that, you know, in both the corporate and non-corporate world, they're just hard skills that you have to have. In order to lead an organization, right? And so for me, it was this kind of, and I think I was speaking of another founder friend as well, that this gap, right, between where you're at in terms of your skills and capacities versus where your organization needs to be. And
right.
That gap really is, in terms of, you know, skill as well as knowledge, is perhaps the, you know, it's very cliche, and, you know, but it's something that will be pressed on, you know, in moments where you don't expect it to.
Right.
And so I think scaling has been very difficult in the sense that not because of the external factors oftentimes, but because how do you navigate internal management? How do you navigate yourself? Because you're suddenly not executing projects, you're suddenly managing projects,
right.
Or you're managing people in that sense. And so having that huge shifts oftentimes, and also from my conversation, hits founders way harder than anyone would expect it to, both in, you know, business and non-business. And so having that gap and, like, knowing how to patch it up is by far one of the more part, you know, fundamental challenges.
So on the flip side, what has been some of your proudest moments?
I mean, AOD, it's, you know, we invest in people, right? Most of our programs and activities are training and putting together an experience for young Malaysians to engage in multicultural Malaysia. I think for me, it's not like, I can't pinpoint like, oh yes, this moment in particular that we're very proud of. But I think for me, it's that pride comes from our volunteers and alumni. So we've trained around, you know, close to 500 alumni at this point, where across our different programs, right? Mm-hmm. And for a lot of them, they keep coming back. Either one, as interns, you know, they're really resonating with our organization and its mission that they can engage in that space and grow personally. And so being able to see personal growth of those younger has been really fulfilling for me. But also, I think having alumni come back as volunteers where they're helping with social media, where they're helping with organized programs, all these things are moments of community growth. And that's really where I think for me has been like, okay, you know, regardless of what people have labeled, you know, the broad labels of like working forward towards diversity and inclusion, it's really the people that have been become the seeds or really places of growth for these kind of broad missions, right? And so where people have been growing is really, you know, a place of community for me as well.
Yeah, I think that's really wonderfully put. How do you measure growth? On this very show, I've spoken to entrepreneurs who, you know, for them, they say it's very simple. Like, essentially, it's, you know, if I have a business and if today my business is making 10,000 ringgit, just obviously just a random number, and tomorrow it's making 20,000 ringgit, for example, then like that is growth. And that's how I measure growth. But you are in an NGO. I'm guessing you don't measure growth that way, but it may also factor in. How do you process whether you're growing, whether it could be year on year, month on month, things like that?
So I think I'll see this in two ways. So one, I think in terms of, you know, if businesses were quantified in numbers, I think I would quantify our growth in terms of people. So very much similar to what I just mentioned, right? It's got to be about community. It's got to be about trusting in that human capital and people being the key point of anything for democracy or any society. And so I think just for me, having scale, just impacting more people, equipping more people, and deepening that connection and growth in people is, for us, growth.
Right.
And so that seems a bit, you know, I think for a lot of NGOs where we're working in the more intangible, so versus, say, humanitarian organizations that, you know, can quantify things in terms of how many food packages they're delivered or looking at socioeconomic standpoints. I think in terms of social change, growth is a lot harder to measure, especially when that change may not happen within the short term. I participated in tons of programs when I was a teen. And I probably like was stagnant in the most like technical bits, stagnating for years because I was just simply in school.
Right.
But that growth might happen, you know, 10 to, you know, 15 years down the line. So that's a bit hard to measure, but I know and trust that intangible value of investing in people and seeing the little, you know, levers change in your head. That's for me a big part of NGO growth. But I think secondly, more on like an internal growth, right? How you be mature, both as individuals, as organizations, because a lot of people, you know, I think it's a strange one. Where people tell me like, oh, wow, you've grown so much in the past 2 years. I'm like, really? Like, I still feel kind of in the same place. I think for me, it's also finding that balance between optimism and realism, right? So it's, you know, we start off with this kind of idealistic vision of like what we want to achieve. And then as we hit more challenges, we become a lot more realistic of that. And I think that part of growth and maturing is knowing where to move between that idealism and realism and saying, okay, these are hard circumstances and this is where I want to be, and knowing where to insert yourself and where to grow into is part of that maturing character. And I think that's, you know, a part of growth that is applicable for both individuals as well as organizations. I mean, throughout the past two years, right, we've had, you know, number of circumstances, be it you know, COVID or changing governments or just very different demands of, you know, where social winds are changing. And knowing where to act on that, I think, is growth itself. Although it might not seem it as is, but I think as, you know, to be cliche and a bit metaphorical, a tree planting its roots, the root has to find out the optimum place to grow into. And so I think a part of maturing and growing is very much that.
What does it feel like, Jason, doing something that you love?
So obviously, it's a sense of privilege, right? I mean, I entered into this, even going to university, was very conscious of this. And then making sure that sense of privilege is also coupled by a sense of responsibility. So I think part of, you know, waking up every day is like having like a weight on your shoulder as well, navigating those places. But I think also, you know, going in the day-to-day is knowing that things might change. And that way of reflecting and being appreciative of the present day is a tough muscle to constantly use. I think I read a quote, I can't remember who said it, but, you know, I wish we had hindsight of when the good old days were. And so maybe perhaps, you know, for myself, where, you know, I'm in this very young place where I have the energy, time, and finances to pursue this kind of crazy, you know, NGO and doing all this kind of experimental work. It might be short-lived. But being appreciative of that, that's a place where I, you know, not many can attain, but also being appreciative of the fact that I'm in a place that I can move in these ways. And being appreciative just means kind of enjoying the moment as well.
Now, before we wrap this conversation up, I just have one more question for you. What advice would you give young people who are contemplating working or starting their own NGO, but are afraid that there's no future for them? And on that very same note, I just want to add another layer to that question, and that, you know, a lot of times, let's say if a student or someone who's in university or even a kid or whatever tells their parents, oh, I want to get into doing, you know, humanitarian work. I want to a push for social change. I want to join an NGO and all. Parents say, hey, can make money or not? You know, like, oh, why you want to waste your time and do this and that? And, you know, there is some sort of, you know, their intent, their questioning comes from a place of good, right? They want you to have a stable life and all of those things. So on that note, what advice would you give young people who have those worries or parents who have those worries? But on another layer that I'm asking is, should you even either start an NGO or want to start an NGO or work for an NGO with the goal of making money, should that even be like a thing? Because it feels like, you know, doctors getting into, you know, I want to study medicine to make money. People say, no, you should study medicine if you want to help people. If your primary goal is to make money, then you can go and become an investment trader or something like that. How do you view this?
So on the first question, right, just about like, you know, and I know now, especially in Malaysia, where we have a lot of kind of burgeoning NGOs where they were very similar places where we were in like 2018, where it's not full time yet. And it's something that you're considering. Mm-hmm. I would say it's tough. It's super tough. I think anyone would say that. And I think for me, I spend years interning and volunteering in different places and even just sitting and thinking about it, right? Of whether it's a possibility or whether there is space and it matches up with my skill set. Mm-hmm. And so I think all these are considerations that you should have reasonable investments of time and energy into thinking about these things first. I also had a massive community of support. I interned at Teach for Malaysia, I interned at Ideas before I even embarked on even starting an NGO. Having that community of support and building that network was critical. Without them, without, you know, peers of very supportive peers, I wouldn't be able to do what I'm doing. And so first, I think it's that. It's thinking and also just preparing the preconditions first. On to the second one where, you know, about finances and your parents. So I think, I, again, very privileged that my parents are very understanding of what I do and very, you know, they know that I'll kind of land on my feet wherever I am. But I think on to the financial bit, obviously, like, you know, finances are, again, as I mentioned before, it cannot be negated.
Right.
Right. But I think what many people don't realize is that the nonprofit scene is very much an industry. There is, you know, in Malaysia, it's not as big, but as we are developing democracy, the nonprofit industry, which bridges the gap between societal needs and government services, is incredibly important, right? In the US, it's a huge billion-dollar industries where, of course, there is some form of stability here, and there are pockets of ways to move. And I think, you know, for many, from my observations, that many people who have, you know, started in a more Wild Wild West, where, you know, you're starting an NGO, you're pursuing these kind of maybe perhaps unstable paths right now, they oftentimes can go up into either working for INGOs or becoming in more stable positions because you are developing these hard skills of project management, mm-hmm. of research, of even just understanding the topics of policy and advocacy. And so these are hard skills that are being built and they're transferable across, say, corporate government relations or being in more fundamental research positions as well. So I wouldn't say that, you know, it's like a complete trade-off of like,
right.
No, you know, like no financial versus like becoming an investment banker.
Right.
Because I think even when I was in university, a lot of people were putting this dichotomy at place. While obviously there are clear kind of far ends of the spectrum, there's so much in between that you can find positions of being in a place where you're working in nonprofit, where you're doing and dealing with issues that you care about, while also making sure that you are in a comfortable place. Now in Malaysia, that position, that those places might be, you know, in the minority, and maybe perhaps you don't have that space yet, but it is growing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part and parcel of it, and especially for listeners here, you know, is Malaysians understanding that philanthropy and just giving back to organizations is part of growing that industry that does service a very important need in society.
On that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Jason. That was Jason Wee, co-founder of Architects of Diversity. If you missed any part of our conversation, you can check us out on podcasts. We're available on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Darshan Johan, and this has been Redefining Success, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.